Welcome to the Data Democracy. Presented by renowned O'Reilly author Olsen Benyu. Empowered by Xenia. Make your data accessible and discoverable by anyone, anywhere, at any time.
Hi everybody, you're listening to The Data Democracy, and I'm your host, Ole Olesen Benyu, Chief Evangelist in Xenia, and the author of the Enterprise Data Catalog published by O'Reilly. In this podcast, we explore what an enterprise data democracy is with knowledgeable guests. Today's guest is Simon Haar. Simon Haar is the creator of Data Mesh Manager, Data Mesh Architecture, both .com, and together with Jochen Christ, he translated Jean-Marc Dagane's book, Data Mesh, into German, with the subtitle, Eine dezentrale Architektur für Daten. He also co-authored Java by Comparison earlier in his career, and he is very proud of that book, as you will hear in a moment. And he has all the reasons to be that. I wanted to invite Simon on to talk about his career, how it was to translate an international bestseller, how he sees Data Mesh community in Germany, and what his plans are for the future. So, my takeaways from my conversation with Simon. First, a data leader takeaway. Make your ideas known, take ownership of them, and communicate them. Simon has done this with great success, as you will hear. A data democracy takeaway. Clean code can be taught simply by comparing it with less clean code. Simon has written a great book about that, as you will hear. And third, a personal takeaway. Simon moved from software to data, and it's a great move, and I wish more people would do it. Software engineers are disciplined by DevOps, and as such, they bring crisp methodological approaches to a field that sorely needs it, data. Okay, enough of me talking. Let's hear what Simon has to say. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Ole.
It's nice to have you on. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, nice to be here with you.
So, for the listeners, do you care to explain a little bit about yourself, where you're based, what you do, your educational background, stuff like that?
Yeah, sure. I'm currently living in the rural area in Germany, in northern Bavaria. And I'm actually a software engineer by heart, by training, a little bit more. So I did a PhD in computer science, but basically I've put that aside. It was just a PhD experience, but I kind of moved on building things, and that's and coding in Java, for instance.
Mm, cool.
And that's where, like, I did 6 years of teaching students Java programming. And from that, I created a book with two colleagues. It's called Java by Comparison. And I'm really proud about that because it was extracted from the teaching experience, helping other students writing cleaner code. And I could talk like 4 hours about this topic as well, but it's not for today.
Oh, well, no, but I did mention that in the introduction, the Java by Comparison, and I was puzzled by the title. I mean, Java by Comparison. Why that title? What does that indicate?
It's the concept of having comparisons to teach people an intuition what cleaner code means. It's not absolute, but relative. So think of having a small snippet of code on the left-hand side of a page showing code that is not so good, and below that an explanation why this is not so great in terms of maintainability and readability. So we are talking 50% only on the problem, and now on the right-hand side, the solution, the better, not solution, it's more the better version of it. We have an improved code snippet and an explanation why this is a little bit better. And that's why it's by comparison. It's this improvement, this, and having it side by side when you have the book open, left side, right side. That's the idea of this comparison format.
That's a cool idea. I like that, Simon. So
yeah. I'm more proud of that than of my PhD, to be honest.
Yeah, but that sometimes happens, right? I mean, yeah. I also have a PhD. I also wrote a book. I also feel more proud about that book than the title, but I think it's a healthy sign, Simon. It's a healthy sign.
Yeah.
Okay, so you taught for how many years? 6 years, was that it? Yeah. At what university was that?
University of Bamberg. That's a very small but awesome town in Germany.
Yeah, yeah, I know it. I know it. And then you went off to build things, right?
First I tried to do a startup, but that's how startup goes. And then I joined the consultancy company InnoQ, where I'm now a consultant. And I did a cool project for 4 years where we did remote mob programming all the time, full time. And that was also great. So basically one person sharing the screen and then rotating basically the person sharing the screen every 10 minutes for the whole time we did the project.
Oh, great. Great. Yeah, I remember those principles, but it's hard to do it in real life. That must have been a fun experience.
Yeah, it was exceptional.
Yeah.
It's like team building as you have never experienced that.
Yeah. Yeah, this is going a little off topic, but I just finished reading Team Topologies by Manuel Pais and Matthew Skilton.
Mm-hmm.
You get that kind of feeling in that book, right? How smooth and easy those teams should collaborate for the fastest flow possible. It's a super cool book to read also. Have to check out your book also, Java by Comparison. We could perhaps already move into some of the questions that I prepared for our conversation here today, Simon, because as I also said in the intro, you are one of the translators, together with Jochen Christ. You translated the data mesh book published by Aurelie and written by Jean-Marc Degani. What was that like? What was it like to translate the book?
It was a fun experience. Basically, I transitioned from the software engineering world into the data world, and the data mesh concept was very intriguing to me, because most of the things were already there in the operational software world, so to say, in software engineering world, and I had the feeling in the data world they are really missing. And so, and at some point we came out, let's do this. And it was a really intense project, 3 or 4 months, very intense, going through that. And because we did that together, like two people translating a book, the interesting part was always the discussions we had on the subtleties of some terms and how to capture the real essence, because translation always means you lose something because it's the languages are not don't have the same expressiveness in some way, and how do you do that? And that was a very interesting but fun experience.
Yeah, you were so kind to send me a copy a long time ago of the German translation. I know a bit of German, and so I not only read your foreword, you wrote a foreword to the German translation, you and your colleague or co-translator, Jochen Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I read that, and I also read several passages of the book. And, you know, there were many things that I thought about, because German is a language that by nature is very precise. You can't really hide in German. Whereas English is more like there's a bit more of plasticity into that language. And I think the Data Mesh book is one of the books that uses that plasticity to be, I won't say vague, but intentionally generic, so that like phrases can be interpreted in several ways. And I really thought, okay, it would be very difficult for many people to translate a universe that is described in this very dreaming, visionary way into something where it's just like German. You really have to be, there's no hiding in German, right? So how did you, I guess that was really difficult.
It was. And to be fair, a lot of the English terms we we kept in English because it's the typically people just use the same, just say the English term in German anyway. Mm-hmm. Didn't always work, of course. And there's no easy solution to that. That's sometimes we had like hours of discussions around specific topics, and at some point you have to throw the dice anyway.
Yeah, obviously. But I think it turned out well. I mean, I don't know if you want to reveal the exact numbers, but it strikes me as a book that is doing quite well in Germany, in German.
I don't have, to be honest, I don't have exact numbers, but I think so too. They had a lot of pre-orders and still selling well, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that it also that there is a German market for translations. Mm-hmm. In this data world, and that's why we did it, basically to bring the idea of data mesh to more people in the German markets. Mm-hmm. Because we think this is such an important and transformational topic people should be educated about.
Yeah, for sure. So I think it's cool that you, as a software engineer, transitioned, I dare say, into data, because software engineering, as you said, these principles are actually up and running. It's working. So I guess in some respects, it's an easier place to be once you have the skill set set up. Software engineering is simply a more mature discipline than data engineering, which is really, really like suffering from some basic problems still. Do you sometimes regret making that change?
No, I think the data is when you see generative AI and all these progressive movement, the innovations happening there, I think I transitioned right in time, because the data is the key to innovation. And data mesh is basically the foundation when you have the data products offering data for others to use. It's the foundation you need for building Gen AI on top. And I think it's just happened just in the right amount of time.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, Simon. I think you're completely right. Okay, so I've also been checking out what you created, the datamesharchitecture.com. Been reading about all the, like, you have a very nice FAQ about data mesh, what data mesh is and what it isn't. So basically, what is datamesharchitecture.com?
So we've created or shared our view of data mesh to the world from the engineering perspective, from the perspective of someone coming from software engineering and wanting to help educate people with our perspective. Because normally, and that's a fun thing, when we are asked to help with data mesh projects, we are asked by data people. Mm-hmm. But we also wanted to show the case, what is data mesh for more people from the software engineering world? Because in the end, when you really apply data mesh, it not just affects like the I don't know, tens, hundreds of data people in your company. It affects the whole organization, including all your software engineers. Mm. And that's when you compare the number of software engineers to the number of data engineers or data people. Mm-hmm. Well, the software engineers are typically in the majority and by a large factor. And we need to move them along that journey as well.
I totally agree, but I also know that is one of the major challenges, right? If you listen to Data Mesh Radio or other podcasts out there that deal specifically with data mesh, it's often the case that it's easy to convince data engineers and data managers in general, right, that they need to, or that they should consider at least the data mesh direction. But it's quite difficult to get in dialogue with software engineers and sort of say the other side of the table. But what's your success stories there? What does good look like in order to make that happen?
I can share a personal story in there, because that's kind of how I transitioned into this data world. Mm-hmm. I was part of a project team building software, and at some point our backlog went dry. We didn't have anything more to do. The next major initiative we were not really part in. And at the same time, people from the data platform team went around and said, hey, we've bought BigQuery, well, for the company, and who wants to play with it? And we had time. We basically said, okay, let's try it out. We pushed all the data we had that was under our control or we got from other teams in the operational world and just ingested it into BigQuery. And then started to think, well, what could we do with the data now? What interesting questions could we ask? What hypotheses? And it turned out, well, we could ask a few interesting questions and we could analyze them. We could implement a feature that improves our product, basically our systems. Mm-hmm. And then we could do an analysis afterwards as well, have some success story. And we did that several times and basically transformed into a data-driven team by the books, data-driven product team. And that was such an awesome experience that I say, okay, we use the data for our own purposes to improve our systems and have a better success in our team. And I think that's one of the key levers for the software people.
Great, great, Simon. I love that story. And if I recall correctly, that's also the story you that you recount in the foreword of the German translation, right? I recall the enthusiasm in the foreword, and I from what you just said, and that is that is super great, because I mean, I think that foreword was quite. It's just a page or two, but it's, for me, it was quite significant what you wrote, because it testified to something else than the original book, the Data Mesh book in English that I obviously read some time ago. Because here we could see this was a testimony from practitioners actually working with this. So I think that was very different in the sense that when the Data Mesh book came out, a lot of people said, this will never happen. People will not do that. And it's too theoretical. It's just a vision, blah, blah, blah. And so it's quite fun for me to see and read in German that, okay, now it's action time. It's a practical reality. People are actually doing this. And this is a firsthand experience of what it feels like when you discover what this architecture can do, right? Or not architecture as such, but, you know, approach. So yeah, that was a lot of fun to read. I think to move on, I would want to know from you, given that you are so centrally placed in terms of carrying the data mesh flag in Germany and in German speaking world, what's the current status of data mesh in Germany in general? I mean, do you have some success stories? Do you see success stories? Well, are there a lot of skepticism still? What's the status?
In general, I would say it's very, very early. We see a lot of people having learned a lot about it, and some are now trying to get on the journey. But in the end, it's mostly at the very beginning. We see some companies like Zalando or HelloFresh, they are a little bit further in the journey. Mm-hmm. But overall, it takes some time. And in Germany, we have a lot of companies also that have a huge background in industry, in production.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult if you haven't transitioned, or don't have a digital model of because there it's much more separated with the domain-driven design is not that there yet, so it's much harder to then say, okay, let's decentralize data, but we didn't decentralize anything before that. That's what we see.
Yeah, I mean, Germany obviously has a lot of, let me see if I can recall the German phrasing of it, Export Weltmeister or something like that. But right, you are an enormous country in Europe, the biggest economy in Europe, with a lot of production and a lot of export and running on a lot of ERP systems that are also natively built, perhaps exactly for that very reason, right? And that is a setup that is both quite profitable and also quite static. I mean, not all companies, I guess, would need to transition from that. However, if you want to stay competitive in new markets and in a new technological landscape, that transition is kind of needed, right? I mean, it's a little bit like what EVs are doing to car manufacturers, for example. You simply need to federate your IT infrastructure if you want to stay competitive and basically produce software that just happens to sit in cars, right? For example.
Yeah, it's not about federation. A lot of these companies are federated already in some way, but it's more making software with data and data analytics a really priority. Regardless whether they previously produced machines or other stuff, but in general, everybody has to go towards this software company, software and data company. To improve these products and enhance them.
Yeah. I am following both Zalando and, mainly Zalando. You mentioned another company also.
Yeah, HelloFresh.
HelloFresh, yes. Obviously, I also follow HelloFresh. And I know they have some good people working strategically with their data agendas. You must know, what's his name, Alexander Borek or something like that from Zalando?
Yeah.
So I know that at least those companies are working very strategically with that. But I guess a lot of companies in Germany are, right? But I'm happy to see that the data mesh movement is gaining momentum also in Germany, obviously.
Yeah, the fun thing is that we have some companies where you shouldn't say data mesh anymore.
Yeah.
But if you say decentralized data architecture with data domain ownership and data as a product and self-serve data platform and computational federal governance, then it's fine.
Yeah. It's a little long, but it's fine.
Yeah. True.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that is a global thing, right?
Yeah.
I went through the same process in my previous position prior to joining Zenia. I was also like really advocating the long sentence you just mentioned there, but it was kind of impossible for me to be allowed to just call it data mesh, even though, I mean... that's simply because people are so they get so divided by that term, right? Is it a good term? Is it a bad term? But basically, it's just a term, right? Let's look at what's under the hood. How do we make this work? How do we build it? And that's what we should be discussing. But anyway, that's one of the difficulties, right?
Yeah, but the fun thing is that nowadays the new term is data contracts.
Yeah. And maybe we should transition into that question, right? So, because you've been very active in the data contract space since I first met you, you've been talking about data contracts and so forth. So what's your take on data contracts, Simon?
I think that's, however you call what you're doing in the data world, at some point you realize you have APIs in the data world as well. And you have to protect them, you have to describe them, you have to document them. And make them, maybe you have to be API first, where you define, we have some requirements, maybe from the GenAI world or some other use cases where say people say, I would like to have this data and how to fill them, fill these needs. And basically for me, data contracts is like API or open API for data. And there are different ways how to do that. But when you have this API, this data API described, you can offer it to many consumers, and they can they can rely on what you guarantee in this data contract, it's called. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, it's a data contract is not a contract, right?
No, you're right.
It is about data, but it's not about, it's just an offering.
Yeah. It's just like a data product. It's not a product. And it's just like the database. it's pretty horrible. Yeah. But anyway, that's how it is. Yeah. So, but tell me more about that. I mean, what's the difference between a real contract, so to say, and a data contract? I think many listeners would be curious to hear you out on that.
Yeah. So a data contract is like an offering, and consumers can come and say, okay, I accept these terms, and then I use it. And I think that's where the actual contract then is agreed on. Perhaps you have to record why are you using the data contract in some way. And a lot of things can be, it's like a usage agreement or something like that. That's built. That's the actual contract that references a data contract.
Yeah.
So that's basically my mental model here. Or data sharing agreement or Informationsflussvereinbarung, however you want to call that.
Yeah. But that was one. You make me think of all those cool words in the German version of the data mesh book, like these long words. They are super cool if you get them. It's really fun to read them. I've not been reading enough German lately, so it was great to get that refreshed. Honestly, in your book, I guess we are at the end of the conversation, Simon. But where can people find you? Where would you advise people to look for you and what you do?
I think just follow me on LinkedIn, connect on LinkedIn, and I think you get a lot of great content there. I try to share my knowledge, and let's get into contact.
Yeah, I can definitely testify to that. You have some very interesting posts on LinkedIn, and I read them with great curiosity. So I want to say thank you for coming, Simon, for being on, and stay in touch.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and yeah, take care.